Good evening, and welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I am your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me today is my brother from another mother, Tom Caldwell. How are you doing, my friend?
Good day, and thank you for having another great episode of our podcast. It's a beautiful day, beautiful warm spring day here in Saskatchewan, so I'm looking forward to our session. This will be a good time.
Yeah, you bet. It is absolutely beautiful out. We have had a miserable winter and a miserable spring, but it is beautiful out there today. My wife is going to be taking the kids to play some basketball at the park while I'm doing this podcast today. But we can't do it alone, and we have our ever-constant foreign correspondent, Chris Haig. How are you doing, my friend?
I am doing well. I'm just getting over a cold, so my voice might still be a bit scratchy, but I am all good, and I'm very excited to be back, particularly doing this episode.
Awesome, right on. And we are very honored to have a very special guest join us today to talk about this film, Farron Nimei. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent. This is a real privilege. We've been sending a few emails back and forth for a little while planning this. I think I reached out to you late last fall saying we wanted you on. We narrowed down that we were going to have you on for The Lady Vanishes. And here we are. About 6 months later, we finally got to this film in our chronology, and we're very excited to have you on. Farron, tell us a little bit about your film writing and your experience with Hitchcock and what you think of Hitchcock and what you think of his works, maybe his, your favorite film of his.
Well, I started out writing about film for a blog that I still have, although it's much more intermittently updated because I have a lot of other stuff kind of going on right now, writing stuff as well. But it's called Self-Styled Siren, and I wrote anonymously for a while. Eventually, I sort of came out of the closet. And the blog kind of led to a bunch of different things. It led to writing for other outlets, which have included a Film Comment, Sight and Sound. I wrote a cover story for Barron's on The Wolf of Wall Street. I've written for some newspapers like The Wall Street Journal, and once or twice The Times. So it really kind of led to a lot of nice opportunities to write about older films, which has always been my specialty. Roughly pre 1960, 1965. That's I certainly love a lot of movies made after that, but that's my bailiwick. Those films tend to be very special to me, and I don't know anybody who loves this period of film history that, doesn't have at least a few Hitchcocks that they really love. And for me, I love nearly everything the man did, before, say up to about Psycho, and even after Psycho, there's good things with that. But, there were a few here and there that I wasn't as crazy about, but overall, to me, he's very clearly one of the greatest filmmakers of them all, and also one of the most enjoyable, one of the most entertaining. It is not a chore to me to sit through a Hitchcock movie. They sparkle, they dazzle, I find something new in them nearly every time. So I'm really excited to talk about The Lady Vanishes.
Is Lady Vanishes your favorite Hitchcock film?
I don't. When I'm asked to name my favorite, I usually say Shadow of a Doubt. But Lady Vanishes is way up there. And right after I've seen Lady Vanishes, I'm always like, wait, well, why don't I just name The Lady Vanishes? Because God knows I love this movie. It's very hard to, I have a pretty fixed Hitchcock top 10, and Lady Vanishes is always in the upper reaches of it.
Mm-hmm. So. It's one of those movies that, it's one of my favorites. It's not my favorite, but it's definitely up there in my top five Hitchcock films. But it's one that when you haven't seen it for a while, it kind of falls underneath the radar, it feels like. And then when you get back to it, you're like, man, that movie's awesome. Like, why do I keep forgetting about how good this film is? It surprises me every time I watch it about how well-paced it is and how great the suspense is. You know, I watched this with my daughter, who's 8. She watched this movie for the first time, and, you know, she was completely captivated by the plot. She had a few questions as to what was going on that I had to explain to her, but it's a very captivating film for all ages.
I mean, I think with Hitchcock, you know, like once the you know, Cahiers du Cinéma crowd came along or whatever and started writing about him, you know, a lot of the later critics, auteurs critics, found the stuff that he made in Hollywood more interesting, particularly like his late period stuff, starting like around. I don't know, maybe The Man Who Knew Too Much, Rear Window, like, you know, the sort of ones that really, you know, become psychologically complex and sort of delve into, you know, some of the nastier sexual urges or whatever. So I think that's one reason why Lady Vanishes maybe, that I think definitely doesn't get its due as a work of art. I mean, everybody acknowledges, including François Truffaut, that it's one of his most enjoyable, lovable movies. But but there's not maybe a lot of people who would argue that, you know, its lovability means it's greater than Vertigo, for example, right? So that's my theory.
It's tough to put sometimes, like, is it a... When you're ranking films, I tend to rank my favorites as the ones that I like to enjoy more. There might be better made Hitchcock films, but, you know, like, Tom and I, our favorite Hitchcock film's Rope. You know, like, it may be not his best produced film, but I just love Rope so much.
I'm really fond of Rope. Really fond of Rope. I wrote, like, a long essay about how much I liked Rope as, like, this sort of orphan Hitchcock that doesn't have as many fans, but...
Yeah. Excellent, right on. Well, we're looking forward to our discussion today on The Lady Vanishes. Tom, will you read us, please, a quick summary on the film?
Sure. This is from one of our favorite source books, Charlotte Chandler's It's Only a Movie. A group of British tourists are snowbound in an alpine lodge, and they finally catch a train out of Balkan country. One passenger, Iris Henderson, is unenthusiastically returning to London to get married. She meets an older lady, Miss Froy, who disappears after a bandaged patient is brought aboard. But when Iris calls attention to Miss Froy's disappearance, nobody will admit that a Miss Froy ever existed. With the exception of an eccentric young musician, Gilbert Redman, they tell their story to Dr. Hartz, who is really a member of the conspiracy to kidnap Miss Froy, taking her off the train as a bandaged patient. So Iris and Gilbert find Miss Froy and free her. She's an English spy on her way to London with an important message encoded in a melody. Before escaping, she teaches Gilbert the melody in case she doesn't make it. So the train is diverted, the passengers are attacked by troops, until they manage to commandeer the engine and drive out of the country. Back in London, Iris chooses Gilbert instead of her fiancé. They go together to the War Office, where Gilbert finds he cannot remember the tune. Then they hear Miss Froy playing it on the next room, and they are reunited, so it's a happy ending. But yeah, very cool film.
Right on. Okay, a little bit of behind the scenes. I have to do this live on the websites. For some reason, my document, my Word document that I created, is not opening on my computer. But Wikipedia lists October 7th, 1938 as the release date for this film. And the British Film Institute ranked The Lady Vanishes the 35th best British film of the 20th century.
Seems kind of low.
Low on the list? Think it should be higher?
I would put it top 20.
Top 20?
Yeah.
Awesome. So The Lady Vanishes was originally called The Lost Lady, and Irish director Roy William Neill was assigned by producer Edward Blake Edward Black to make it. A crew was dispatched to Yugoslavia to do background shots, but when the Yugoslav police accidentally discovered that they were not well portrayed in the script, they kicked the crew out of the country, and Black scrapped the project. A year later, Hitchcock could not come up with a property to direct to fulfill his contract with Black, so he accepted when he was offered The Lost Lady to him. Hitchcock worked with the writers to make some changes to tighten up the opening and the ending of the story, but otherwise the script did not change very much. Now, for lead characters in this film, we have Margaret Lockwood, and she made her stage debut at the age of 12 and trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, where she was seen by a talent scout and signed to a contract. In 1935, she appeared in the film version of Lorna Doone, and in 1938, she played the role of Jenny Sunley, the self-centered, frivolous wife of Michael Redgrave's character in the film The Stars Look Down. In the early 40s, she changed her on-screen image to play villainesses in both contemporary and period films, becoming the most successful actress in British films during that period. Her greatest success was in the title role in The Wicked Lady from 1945, which was a film which was controversial in its day and brought Lockwood considerable publicity. She lived her final years in seclusion and died in Kensington, London from cirrhosis of the liver at age 73. This is her only Hitchcock appearance, but a similar style of film that listeners may enjoy is Night Train to Munich from 1940. Michael Redgrave was born March 20th, 1908, and he was born in Bristol, England, the son of silent film actor Roy Redgrave and actress Margaret Scudamore. He never knew his father, who left when the boy was 6 months old to pursue a career in Australia, and he died when Redgrave was 14. His mother subsequently married Captain James Anderson, a tea planter. Redgrave apparently greatly disliked his stepfather. Redgrave made his first professional appearance at the Playhouse in Liverpool on the 30th of August, 1934, as Roy Darwin in Counselor at Law, then spent 2 years with its Liverpool Repertory Company, where he met his future wife, Rachel Kempson. They married on the 18th of July, 1935. In the 30s, he was offered a job by Tyrone Guthrie. Redgrave made his first professional debut in London at the Old Vic on the 14th of September, 36, playing Ferdinand in Love's Labour's Lost. During 36 and 37, he also played Mr. Horner in The Country Wife, Orlando in As You Like It, Warbeck in The Witch of Edmonton, and Laertes to Laurence Olivier's Hamlet. His hit of the season was Orlando. Edith Evans was his Rosalind, and the two fell very much in love. As he later explained, Edith always had a habit of falling in love with her leading men. With us, it just went a little bit further. Now, Michael Redgrave, we also saw him in his Secret Agent as an army captain on a train, and it was uncredited. But other than that, this will be his last Hitchcock appearance. Paul Lucas was born May 26, 1894, and he was a Hungarian actor. Lucas made his stage debut in Budapest in 1916 and his film debut in 1917. At first, he played elegant, smooth womanizers, but increasingly he became typecast as a villain. He had a successful stage and film career in Hungary, Germany, and Austria, where he worked with Max Reinhardt. He arrived in Hollywood in 1927 and became a naturalized citizen of the United States in 1937. He was busy in the 30s, appearing in such films as the melodrama Rockabye, the crime caper Grumpy, The Lady Vanishes, the comedy Ladies in Love, and the drama Dodsworth. He followed William Powell and Basil Rathbone, portraying the series of detective Philo Vance, a cosmopolitan New Yorker, once in The Casino Murder Case. His major film success came in Watch on the Rhine from 1943, where he played a man working against the Nazis, a role originated in the Broadway premiere of the play of the same name in 1941. This is his only appearance in a Hitchcock film. And last, we'll talk about Mae Whitty, Dame Mae Whitty. She was born Mary Louise Webster, June 19th, 1865, and she died in May 29th, 1948. She was an English stage and film actress, and she was one of the first two women entertainers to become a dame. The British Actors Union Equity was established in her home. After a successful career, she moved over to Hollywood films at the age of 72. She went to live in America, where she won awards for her film roles. and then we will see her again in Suspicion. So that's a little bit about the history and the making of the film. Shall we jump into the discussion? What's really interesting about this film, I think, the first part is how long it takes for the action to get going. So it's about 24 or 25 minutes into the film before we get the strangulation of the guitar player, before the plot really starts to going. And it almost seems rather shocking that this happens because there's so much character development so early in the film. So Farron, what do you think of this and how long it takes, how long Hitchcock takes to build up this film?
Well, it's a exceptionally well-constructed screenplay because, you know, none of those 25 minutes are like wasted. None of it's filler. It's all establishing the characters and things that are going to be important later on. You don't realize it at the time because, you know, he's not heavy-handed that way. But you have Charters and Caldecott, you know, and their obsession with the cricket scores and whether or not they're going to get those on time, you know, and it may seem like it's just, you know, sort of, you know, charming background noise, but that their cricket obsession is going to become hugely important later on. And then you have the unsympathetic businessman who's like, you know, on the run from his wife, having an affair, trying not to be found out, you know, because he doesn't want to be served with divorce papers. And again, that may seem, you know, like a kind of throwaway thing, but it's going to become very important later on. You have the rather delightful setup of Iris's relationship with Gilbert. It's very similar to a Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers film, you know, where he's got all of the folk dancers, you know, hilariously like filmed by Hitchcock, you know, just like with these grim expressions jumping up and down around his room, you know, and then you have Iris, you know, trying to get him to quiet down. And there's a lovely sense of banter. You know, right away, you can tell that these, you know, two characters are kind of meant for each other, if only because they dislike one another so heartily. And that's the way it goes in movies. So, he really takes his time. But people are not used to that anymore. When I try to show people The Lady Vanishes, often they're kind of like, they spend the first 20 minutes like, what's going on? You know, is this a Hitchcock movie or what? And then, as you say, the guy gets strangled under the window and you realize, oh yeah, this is a thriller.
I found it very amusing and it really did come across like a comedy off the top. Mm-hmm. And it's that classic stuck in the wilderness. It's almost like Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know, like the car broke down, we need a hotel for the night. Mm-hmm. And a very funny situation comedy with the men having to share the room with the maid and all that. And like you said, that scene with the folk dancers,
yeah,
performing for the clarinet player, that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. I thought at first that maybe he was like a painter, like a sketch artist, like he was doing sketches of them in their costumes. But that was that whole first opening sequences were very funny, very entertaining. I really enjoyed it for sure.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what did you think of the introduction of the movie?
Oh, I loved it. And I completely agree with what you guys are saying. It reminded me so much of almost a bit like It Happened One Night, in the way that kind of Iris and Gilbert's relationship is set up, because, you know, they're thrown together and they hate each other to start with. It's like a lot of the screwball comedies from the 1930s, and it's just really fun. And because I'll be honest, the first time I watched this, Gilbert was driving me mad, and I was just like, listen, I know you're supposed to be charming, but please just get off the bed. And then, you know, on subsequent things, I'm like, okay, this is fine, this is charming, and this all sort of thing. But I do like how it does set up kind of our core group of characters, and, you know, gives us our heroine and gives us our hero and all this kind of thing. And, you know, you get the kind of the comedy value, like you said, in the two cricket-obsessed Englishmen, which is definitely not a stereotype or anything.
Do you like cricket, Chris?
Okay. Like, don't come at me on Twitter or anything. I don't. I work with people who do, to the point where a colleague of mine, when this is released and everything, she'll have been on holiday, but she's going on a 3-week cricketing holiday through Europe, and I can't imagine anything Like, I just don't understand it.
So 3 weeks, that's pretty much one game of cricket, isn't it?
I mean, I'm kind of offended on behalf of my country, but also, yeah, it's so long. I've sat through NFL games before when I've, you know, when they've come over to Wembley and everything, and I've been sat there for like 6 hours and I've been like, it's pretty much cricket. Everyone stops as much. It's just, you know, the uniforms are a bit more colourful in NFL. I love this film. I completely, wholeheartedly love this film, but I love the opening sequence. I love how, you know, for the first 20 minutes or so, you do think, oh, okay, this might be kind of a, you know, a relationship thing, it might be this. And then when the poor guy gets strangled under the window,
mm-hmm.
it then becomes, oh, wow, this is, yeah, this, you know, like you said, this is still definitely a Hitchcock thriller,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there is something insidious at work here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just, it reminds me a lot of, and it's much more stretched out than The Man Who Knew Too Much. But in the same way, we got introduced to our kind of key characters, and then, you know, we spent enough time, a bit of development and all that sort of thing, and then the spy element gets kind of like thrown in, and that's what the, you know, that's what it feels like. Because even if we don't know why this, you know, this person's been strangled under Miss Froy's window or something, we're kind of thinking, oh, okay, oh, this is, you know, this is something, and then it kind of emerges throughout the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. See, the first time I watched it, I thought it was Gilbert killing him as the competition for his music.
There shall be one.
See, what I love most about this opening sequence, like, so we've talked a couple of times, and we've talked on some of the screwball comedies that we've covered so far, like the screwball comedy aspect, and how I'm not really a big fan of that. But the comedy really works for me in this movie, like it hasn't so far. Like, I don't really like the comedic elements in the 39 Steps, you know, and when we covered that, that was one of the detractors for me, just because I don't normally watch comedies. But in this, it was so charming, and the comedic elements were so realistic, you know, like the two guys with the cricket. I'm sorry, I'm bad with names too. Calders and Caldecott, or something like that.
Charters and Caldecott. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Their obsession with the cricket score, you know, and that we get that instance where he picks up the phone that's not for him, and he's like, "No, I'm not the guy you want to talk to. I just want you to tell me the cricket score." And they're so upset that the guy doesn't know the score that they hang up on him, and it's this call that this guy's been waiting for.
Yeah.
And knowing the era and knowing the storm that they've just had, you know, it's totally believable that phone lines in this time would be difficult to get a call through, you know? And so for this call to finally come through, you know, I remember when I was a kid and long distance was very expensive, and it'd be like, okay, grandma's calling. You could talk to her for 1 minute. And this is the 80s, right? You talk to her for 1 minute. That's it. Then you got to pass the phone because it's too expensive. So the frustration of whoever this guy was that was waiting for this call. We don't even find out who this guy is. We just see that he doesn't end up getting his phone call because the phone had been hung up on. But it's really, really charming comedy. And I really like how it starts. So when the guitar player gets killed, it's extremely shocking when it happens. Every time I watch this film, and I've seen this film a dozen times, this is one of the first Hitchcock films that I owned on DVD. I hadn't seen it, but I was eager to get it. I have that. I still have the first printing of the original Criterion DVD, and I got the next one on DVD, and I have it on Blu-ray now. You know, but I've been watching this movie for over 20 years now, and it surprises me every time I see it. So I think that the opening is done perfectly because that shock, that twist, it really catches me off guard every time I watch the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing that gets me in it is just talking about the comedy and everything, because this is one of the funniest Hitchcock films, and I really enjoy it, and it's very lighthearted at its essence. But I described this to someone, and I went, it's basically a thriller about Nazis who aren't actually Nazis yet, and the rise of fascism, but it's also really funny and lighthearted. And they went, what can, and I went, I can't describe it, you're gonna have to watch it. And it is, it's, you know, for its actual subject matter, if you took away the comment, you're like, oh wow, this is about, you know, it's a spy thriller, people are getting killed, it's about kind of trying to defeat fascism, and this is, you know, this is released in, you know, 1938, which, so it's kind of in the lead up to World War II and kind of the tensions in Europe and all that sort of thing, and it probably is influenced away, because I think the original source material, which is The Wheel Spins, which I think I read about 10 years ago or something, mm-hmm. It's more socialism, that's mm-hmm. or it's like just general fascism that's the thing they're fighting against. But they come across as like just Nazis in mm-hmm. this. So it's, yeah, for a film that manages to pull off this kind of high wire act, this balancing act of, it's going to talk about some, you know, some real issues, and it's going to be a fun thriller, and it's still going to be funny and have likeable characters and have like little arcs for all of the kind of secondary characters throughout, like the Todd Hunters and, you know, Charters and Charters and Caldicott and all that sort of thing. They're so hard names to say. I'm just the cricket guys. I'm just going to call them the cricket guys. More than lose my mind. But yeah, I just think it just pulls the comedy off in particular really well. I think this is what makes it one of the most accessible. That Hitchcock films are accessible, but it's especially accessible, particularly to, you know, a younger audience. Like you were mm-hmm. mentioning, Brandon, that your daughter watched this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we watched. Yeah, she loved it. She thought it was really good. So, one of the things I wanted to address with you that you mentioned is, so one of our favorite reference material is Donald Spotto's The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of His Motion Pictures. And he wrote in here, like, so I'm getting it out of here, but the MacGuffin in this film is so, it's just off the wall, unimportant, you know? And that's what makes it so interesting. Like, Aubrey was actually kind of frustrated that we never found out what it was. And, you know, when yeah. we were watching The 39 Steps, I watched it with my wife. And she was actually upset. Like, I find it fascinating that these people that haven't seen these movies before, they're like, I want to know what the MacGuffin is. And it's like, well, it doesn't matter what it is. You know, so I got to try and explain that whole thing to them. But in this, it's the secret clause of a peace treaty between two countries. That's it. We don't know what countries. We don't know what this peace treaty is. We don't know anything. And he also quoted in here, Francois Truffaut to Alfred Hitchcock here, the MacGuffin should turn out to be as trivial and absurd as the little tune of The Lady Vanishes, you know. And I don't know, I think it's interesting because I understand that it doesn't matter, it's just there to drive the plot. But both my wife for The 39 Steps and my daughter for The Lady Vanishes were like upset that they didn't find out what it actually meant.
I think we're used now to watching a lot of movies that, you know, will like explain everything down to the last detail. You think about how much background and backstory is in, you know, like even action movies these days, you know. And I think Hitchcock would have disdained that. He would have said, you know, we don't need any of that. You know, we're just going to cut it out and let the audience guess what the hell is going on. And I think, mm-hmm. I mean, there were people, I'm sure, back in 1938 who were also like, what, a peace clause? Mm-hmm. Come on. We could probably even find critics who were writing that. But, you know, mm-hmm. Hitchcock called them the plausibles. He just didn't care. You know, he wanted to sweep you up in the story. And he, you know, didn't want you to be worrying about the details too much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his best movies always succeed in that mm-hmm. respect.
So as we get into the action on the train here, Tom, I'll start with you. Did you have a favorite secondary character or characters that are on this train? Is there anybody that really stuck out to you as a favorite?
I really got a kick out of Dr. Hartz, and I was about to do a screen grab. There's one moment where he's got Gilbert and Iris in a closed compartment on the train, and he has that little facial expression that totally reminded me of Dr. Evil for a moment there. But he was brilliant.
This was not subtle.
I was I laughed because, and I almost had a flashback to Airplane! ! Mm-hmm. Because Iris gets on the train right after suffering a potted plant to the head. Potential, you know, brain injury or a thump to the head that's left her dizzy. And suddenly, I can just imagine someone going, is there a brain surgeon on board?
Yeah.
Like, you know, a doctor on board would be handy, but actually we need a brain surgeon. So when he showed up as a brain surgeon, that was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed him as a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And he did the part very well. He was evil. He was bad. And I also found it's almost like the mummy trick, you know, like the Invisible Man, where they just wrap them in bandages. Yeah. So this patient that's on the train and is just wrapped in bandages. It was very convenient. It didn't make a lot of sense, but it was kind of a corny way to disguise somebody, but it worked because we didn't know who it was for the longest time.
Yeah, right on. Chris, did you have a favorite secondary character in the film?
I mean, I love them all. Because there's... Yeah, I will go with the nun who wasn't a nun. Because I just... I love her. And it's amazing. And she has her own little arc in the film where she starts off lying and she's like, oh no, I'm really... You know, I'm just a nun. And then we were chatting in our little Facebook Messenger group before this and Tom was like, oh yeah, the false nun in high heels. Mm-hmm. And I was like, if I don't make my Twitter bio at some stage, I'm just a false nun in high heels, I'll be very disappointed. I liked her kind of little redemption moment when she was like, no, I can't go through with this. And then I think, right, because I mean, I watched it again yesterday and I still don't quite know what happens to her. Because it's like, she gets shot, but she's alive, but then you never see her again. Mm-hmm. So but then you don't see any really of the others again either. So I'm just like, is she, you know, was she arrested? Is she alive? You know, was she kind of like, oh, well, I was in on it and now I'm, you know, I changed my mind and I saved, you know, the life and everything. I liked her. I mean, it's because she's adorable. I also really like Miss Froy. And I know she in herself is a bit of a MacGuffin. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like, oh, she's there just to drive the plot and everything. But I really liked her. I love the ending. It's got one of my favourite Hitchcock endings because it's just a really positive, happy ending. Mm-hmm. You know, and it pulls on the heartstrings. And even the... Because they've remade it a couple of times where there's a... It's either 78 or 79 where it's like Sybil Shepherd. And Angela Lansbury are in it. And it's very much of its time and everything, and it's fine. But they do the same thing, but it's a... It's vocalising, where it's not a... It's not like words, it's just la-la-la-la-la-la-la, like that sort of thing. Scat it's that in the 70s version, and you just walk in and Angela Lansbury's there, and it's the maddest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I liked Miss Froy. I thought... You know, I just liked them all. I was intrigued by the magician, who I, upon watching it, because his surname with the whole Signor, is it Doppio? The magician, Signor Doppio, which is very similar to the Italian word doppio, which means double, which I thought was interesting. Because I speak a tiny bit of Italian, and it just a doppio is literally a double, which I thought was kind of cool how this relation to switching out.
Okay.
Miss Fry and everything. Yeah. I liked the characters. They were very likable, even though we had no idea quite what the villains were up to. Mm-hmm. like you pointed out, kind of going like, oh, yeah, no, it's all this intelligence and other thing. What is it actually for? No idea. You know, we'll never solve what the MacGuffin actually is. You know, similar to like, you know, Man Who Knew So Much. You don't really know why they had to assassinate the guy at the opera, or, you know, it's used so much, but at the end it doesn't really matter. It's not so much the destination as it is the journey.
Mm-hmm. You got it. Yeah. Farron, did you have a favorite secondary character in the film?
Oh, Miss Froy. I just love her. Dame May Whitty does such a superb job, because really, you know, your whole investment in the thriller part of the movie depends on, you know, how badly you want them to find Miss Froy. And she's so charming in her first scene, you know, with Margaret Lockwood, you know, it rhymes with joy, you know. And, you know, and then like writing her name on the window. I mean, she's completely adorable. You immediately see why Iris would like take her to heart as like kind of a motherly figure. And, you know, and you also, at least I understand completely why Iris flips out when she simply disappears, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also a certain like kind of righteous indignation that Iris has, because you know, it's sort of a sad truism that people say, you know, that like once you get old as a woman, people don't notice you as much, they don't see you as much. And you know, this movie is almost kind of the embodiment of that, you know. And Iris is the one running around saying, I saw her, I loved her, I cared about her. And I think that they do a beautiful job of making that plausible, you know, not just any old lady would make you believe, you know, that beautiful young Margaret Lockwood is going to run up and down a train making a nuisance of herself to find. So,
yeah. So we're kind of at that plot point right now in the film where, you know, everybody's denying that they've seen Miss Freud. Now that she's disappeared, she's vanished. And, you know, one of the things that we've tried to come to terms with when we do this podcast is unfortunately, we have to look through things through a kind of a modern lens right now as well, as we're made aware of issues and stuff. And I almost feel, with what I know now about, you know, social commentary, is an almost acceptable name for this film now would be Night Train by Gaslight.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she's going through and everybody's telling her, no, you don't know what you're talking about. You're crazy. This woman doesn't exist. And there, you know, like there's this term out there called gaslighting, where, you know, you tell people that they're wrong, even though they know they're right. And it like messes with them and messes them up. And I mean, it's the plot of the film, but it's also now a term that is on the social forefront and the social mind of the forefront.
I believe the British version of Gaslight, or at any rate the play that it was based on, had already come out. So I don't know if the term was current, but I mean you do find that a lot in Hitchcock movies. If I had to compare this one to any of like his later films, it would be North by Northwest, where you have like very much kind of the same thing of Cary Grant running around unable to get people, to even his own mother, to believe that he's being pursued by a bunch of dastardly spies. So, you know, it's, I mean, we often think of it as sort of being something that's, you know, specifically done to women, but Hitchcock likes to do it to a lot of his protagonists. Iris sort of has it particularly badly, but, you know, all of the people that she's going up to have their own reasons for, you know, quite selfish, and in the case of the cricket guys, you know, even trivial reasons for like denying that they've seen this woman. But you start to, you know, that Lockwood makes you feel her distress, you know, so.
I think my favorite turn, and again, I'm bad with the names in here, is how they refer to it as Mr. and Mrs. Todd Hunter. So I think that's my favorite of all the denials because of what they have going on, right? So, I mean, like, my daughter's 8, so I had to explain to her what an affair is so that she could understand the context of what's going on with this movie, right? So I'm like, okay, so here's what an affair is. I think I like that the best, because the woman is like, you could tell there's angst between them because the passion is gone. The passion of this affair is gone. And so she tells Iris, yes, I did see her, just to get back at this guy. And then she's like, well, if we do have a controversy, then you're going to have to divorce. And she's like, there's no way my wife's divorcing me. And then, so because of that, she's like, well, I'm not going to go through no controversy alone. So now I'm going to lie about it. I don't know. I love that. And I think that's the best denial out of all of them, the most intriguing one. So, Chris, what do you think about the denials?
I think, you know, you are right in terms of the gaslight and everything. I think the actual term became popularized after the film. I think it's the Ingrid Bergman film.
There was a British film before that with was it called Gaslight as well? And it's with Anton Valbrook and Diana Wynyard. And I don't know when that came out, but then it was based on a play that had had a long run before.
Yeah.
That's where the term's from then. Okay, yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, because of the husband who's trying to drive his heiress wife insane so that he can get her committed and kind of take over his life and everything. Yeah, 1940. Yeah, that's, yeah. But no, it's infuriating on our side, as, you know, because, you know, Iris is our protagonist in this, and so we naturally want to kind of go, well, no, of course you saw, of course she's real, Miss Frey, and all that sort of thing. I think it's interesting how this concept has kind of filtered down into modern cinema. Like, the one I always remember is, there was a movie 2007 called Flight Plan. I don't know if any of you guys remember it.
I don't remember, no.
Which is, it's a Jodie Foster thriller, and it's ace, it's great, but it's basically the same conceit. Mm-hmm. So Jodie Foster is on a plane, and, you know, she's with her young daughter, and her husband's died recently, and the daughter's there, and the daughter vanishes, and nobody claims to have seen her. And they keep going like, well, no, there wasn't a girl in that seat. There wasn't, you know, you booked two tickets, but there was only one person, or, you know, the seat was unoccupied, or whatever it is. And it's that same conspiracy. And it literally plays out beat for beat the same, except it just happens to be on, like, a Boeing 747 or something. And it was interesting kind of rewatching that, having seen Flight Plan. I think I saw it sometime last year with a couple of friends. And it's that kind of infuriating. And I think as well, because of, you know, the mention of gaslighting and gaslight, the fact it happens to a female protagonist in the modern day is, yeah, like you said, with social commentary and everything, it's just, it's a bit, I felt uncomfortable, because gaslighting itself is a term that's kind of associated, you know, with kind of domestic abuse and domestic violence and all that sort of thing. So watching that kind of stuff, you know, weirdly, I was fine in the 30s, because it's kind of like, oh, it's distance and all that sort of thing. But watching films that do it now, I'm like, oh, wow, okay, this is, you're really just going to flat out just not even consider it, or, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I thought the Todd Hunter stuff was funny. I liked how British it was of Charters and Caldecott just to be like, no, we're going to miss the game otherwise. We're not going to... And we're like, no, we didn't see her either. You're like, you literally asked for salt. Or she asked for salt from you, or a tea bag or something. Can't remember.
Sugar.
And you handed it to... Oh, sugar, yeah.
They were using the sugar cubes to reenact the cricket match.
Yeah. And it was just like, oh, no, but if you know, if there's an investigation, it'll slow down the train. I was just like... Just how selfish have you got to be that someone else's potential demise, disappearance, death, and it's like, yeah, but it'll affect the game. Oh, in which case?
Mm-hmm.
I just, yeah, it's funny. It's all played up very much for kind of comedic sake and all that sort of thing. Looking back on it now, some of it is definite behaviour where you'd be like, oh, wow, this is kind of very creepy and everything. And BBC did do a 2013, a remake of it that kind of played up to this a lot more and was very strict to the original book. But it was the same thing where it was like, oh, well, you know, she's just a woman. How can she, you know, oh, well, she's delusional, or, you know, hysterics, or, oh, you know, and it was just all kind of the men talking down to her and going like, you don't know what you saw, you don't know. It was just, yeah, it was very uncomfortable to watch, but I think it is unfortunately kind of symptomatic of the time. So.
Well, I mean, I should correct myself, because the play Angel Street, which, you know, gave rise to the term gaslighting, actually came out at the end of 38, so after this movie was released. But I mean, there must have been something in the air for everybody to kind of be doing these things simultaneously. But I've always strongly felt that The Lady Vanishes was one of Hitchcock's most feminist films. You know, I mean, you have Margaret Lockwood as a heroine. You know, she you know, like, grabs onto this and will not let go. She's going through, you know, and no matter how big a jerk, you know, Charters and Caldecott are being to her, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Todd Hunter, you know, no matter the doctor trying to convince her she's out of her mind, she is just a bloodhound, and she eventually gains the respect of Michael Redgrave. And, you know, and then you have Miss Roy, who is, you know, like this nice little old lady who is actually an exceedingly dangerous international spy. Now, I mean, to me, these are, you know, like the essence of strong female characters. And, you know, even even the ones who are not as nice, right? Like the nun who is not a nun. She has an attack of conscience. Mrs. Todd Hunter eventually, like, wakes up to the fact that she's on the train with by far the person on it and behaves accordingly. I mean, I find this a very positive film in that regard, you know, because it's really about them overcoming the way that, you know, men trivialize and dismiss them. I mean, they are the bosses.
No?
Can I get...
Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
Sorry, I wanted to hit on, if we're talking about the opening of the film being such a comedic chapter, there's a brilliant sort of sitcom moment in the middle when they're on the train, but they're fighting with the magician in the stock car, which I call stock car because it was full of livestock. And it was brilliant. It was a bit of a flashback or flash forward to Rope, where they drop the magician into the chest and they sit on the chest. And then it's funny because he's a magician and he has a false back on the chest and escapes, right? And then they put him in the booth and he goes out the back of the booth. And there's ducks and rabbits and geese and a cow. And it's quite funny. It's quite a funny fight scene. Mm-hmm. And the two men are fighting for their life and death on the ground, and Iris is basically, what do you want me to do? Bump him in the head, you know? It was a very funny scene. I quite enjoyed that part of the film.
We don't get a train sequence that surpasses this for an action scene on a train until Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
There you go.
Well, I was thinking, is that like, is it a little nod that?
Because
he does do the whole thing with the dream.
Excellent. Okay, so let's get to the action sequence at the end. So, before we get to that, there's one thing that I want to say. What I love about this film as well is it's a locked room mystery without them being in a locked room. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a really fascinating concept. Like, they even get to the point where they stop at the one station and they're, like, looking to see if anybody's getting off the train at all. But it's basically a locked room mystery without being in a locked room. And I really love that. I love trains. I mean, Tom and I know each other from the board gaming community here in Regina, Saskatchewan. And I love train board games. I just love everything about trains. They hold such a mystique. They're this really interesting way to travel because, you know, they do take a long time. But you're getting to go through these places that you can't go with a car. You know, you can go to these wonderful places on a train and see these wonderful sights. And so trains have always held a sense of mystique to me as it is, and a sense of mystery to me as it is. So to have a mystery on this mysterious environment amplifies it for me and is one of the reasons why this movie is such a special film for me and why it holds such a special place for me. So I wanted to address that because I thought it was really cool.
Brandon, just supporting you, talking about trains from the book by Peter Ackroyd.
Yeah.
Hitchcock loved trains. The corridors invoke panic and urgency and speed. The compartments offer only the illusion of safety and privacy. All is in suspense as the train hurtles through the unfamiliar landscape. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what you're saying. Like, it's you're caught. You're stuck there together. You mm-hmm. have no way to get away from each other.
Right on. So we've got this interesting climax that kind of it's kind of a fascinating climax where they've got this shootout at the end of the film. They've diverted the train. They've taken all the extra cars off. They've diverted it to this secondary track, and you know, we've got these, you know, again, they're basically Nazis, but we're not told that they're Nazis, want to get on the train so that they can get Mrs. Froy, right? Because of the secret that she holds in the song. Well, we don't find out the time, it's the song. But how do you guys feel about the climactic sequence? Tom, we'll start with you this time. What do you think about the climactic sequence in the gun battle? Does it fit in the movie? Does it feel odd? What do you think?
It felt good, and it was a nice way to reveal who the bad guys were. Mm-hmm. And like you said, they're generic. They're not quite Nazis, right? But they look the part. Mm-hmm. They have the outfits. But it was a shootout in the Wild West sense of a gun shootout, but very low key, kind of a relaxed shootout. And there was a lot of stuff going on. Like they weren't taking it seriously. They were not worried that they were going to get shot through the wall of that train. Like they were not hiding and running the way they should have. So it was a little unbelievable that those bullets weren't connecting the way they should. But no, I think it was a great way to end the film, and it was a nice way to show us who the bad guys are. It gave Mrs. Froy a reason to explain herself as a spy and mm-hmm. what her mission was. And I thought it was a very, very interesting way to end the film.
Mm-hmm. Farron, what did you think of the climax of the film?
Well, it's kind of where the movie sort of veers into kind of full-blown allegory. I remember the first time I saw this in a theater, like the audience just reaction to it, because, you know, especially from this distance, it's so obviously, you know, like trying to invoke, like, you know, European appeasement or whatever. This movie came out, like, you said it was October something. It was like days after Munich, right? And it might have even been just after Hitler got the Sudetenland. So imagine, like, that was on your newsreel, and then you sit down at The Lady Vanishes, and you've got the British guy trying to go out and wave the white flag in front of the Nazis. It's I think it's a tribute to Hitchcock's lightness of touch, that it doesn't become overbearing. Right. I mean, it doesn't suddenly turn the movie into this, you know, like extreme, serious, you know, like condemnation of, you know, supine Europe in the face of Nazi. You know, it makes the point, you know, and it does it while still carrying on the plot and the thriller aspects very nicely. I think Hitchcock, by the way, was always kind of cagey about whether or not this actually was allegory, but I you'd have to be brain dead. You know what I mean? is there really any way that it's not?
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you think of the climax?
I really enjoyed it. It was comparing it to the original novel, which ends very differently, and which takes the heroine out of action for kind of like the last quarter of it, okay. Which is a bit unsatisfying and everything. This is a lot better, and I really enjoyed it, and, you know, I agree with you guys in that it kind of, the first time you watch it might seem like, oh, this gunfight kind of comes out of nowhere, because it's been kind of a low-key, you know, mystery thriller, that sort of thing, that suddenly becomes a shootout. I am stealing Tom's turn of relaxed shootout, though. That is the funniest thing that I've heard in a while. There's someone being like, are we just going to shoot me? I love it. But no, I really, really enjoy the climax of this. I think it pays off a lot of character stuff. I think you get to see, you know, it does have that bit of exposition where Miss Froy kind of goes, okay, so here's kind of why, even though you don't know why. You know mm-hmm. why she is so important. You know, and it kind of does reframe her character from being, oh, I'm just sweet, and I'm, you know, oh, I'm, you know, this and that, and you're like, oh, wow, no, you are actually, like, an important, you know, intelligence agent, and that's awesome, and that's great. Mm-hmm. It kind of resolves the Todd Hunter thing, which I thought was fine. I thought it was kind of in character, and he wasn't really a villain, he just was an unlikable mm-hmm. secondary character. And, you know, it resolves that sort of thing. You get some nice heroic moments. I enjoyed it. It was just a fun sequence to kind of close things off. And it kind of gave some stakes in the sense of it wasn't just, oh, well, it's a mysterious thing that may or may not have repercussions. You got to see, oh, wow, the people on the other end are willing to kill a trainload of people for this. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. You know, and it did raise the stakes, and it kind of made the payoff and the kind of the denouement, the, you know, the epilogue and everything a lot sweeter, because you got to see, you know, Mr. Right, yep, she escaped. And it actually gives her a nice bit of suspense as well, because you know, you don't just think, oh, well, she's going to be on the train. You know, it gives Gilbert a little mission as a musician to remember the thing. It sets up a lot of stuff, which it then pays off in the last 2 or 3 minutes when they reach Whitehall and they go, oh, wow, okay, we've got to deliver the code and all that, you know, that sort of thing. And it comes in and it has that really nice moment. So, yeah, I really enjoy this. It's one of... I don't think Hitchcock tends to do a lot of shootouts. There was one in Man Who Knew Too Much. There's this... I can't think of a huge number he did. But they were, you know, they were enjoyable, and this is just kind of a great way to basically make the third act of a film.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, there's so much more that we've barely scratched on and barely touched on, but we've been going for almost an hour now, so I want to wrap up the episode here. Farron, is there any aspects of the film that we haven't touched on yet that you really think we need to talk about?
I share your love for train films, and so I just wanted to mention my favorite shot in the movie when they, you know, going through the tunnel, and then afterward you see where she wrote her name on the glass,
oh,
Freud.
Yes. Oh.
I mean, that yes. It's just one of the most beautiful moments, and it's gorgeously timed too, because you are just about ready to slap somebody because nobody's listening to Iris. And so I love that shot.
Yes. Yeah, that's amazing, like, too, because you're sitting there upon rewatches, too, because you can see it, because you know it's there.
Yeah.
Freud, look at the window! Look at the window! You know, and then on the train as well, like, we do get that awesome shot when we think the glasses are poisoned. We didn't even talk about that, the Hitchcock shot in the film, where the glasses are so large in the front of the frame there, with the bad guy behind them, the brain surgeon behind him, you know, like, you know, that's such a great Hitchcock moment to keep the suspense of, like, are they going to drink the poison drink, which turns out not to be poison anyways, but, you know. Tom, is there anything else on the film that we haven't talked about yet that you'd like to address?
Just confirming something that Farron talked about earlier. Mrs. Freud makes a great spy because she's an older lady that blends into the crowd and nobody's going to spot her. She's not standing out in the crowd. She's blending in the background. She's going to get away with things. She's going to walk around and not be discovered. And I thought that was a really good bit of casting, a bit of writing to have her character being that woman that can blend in very easily.
It's her superpower.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Chris, did you have anything else you wanted to address? Any final thoughts?
No, I just really enjoy this film. And, you know, circling back to the start, it's a shame that this isn't talked about more. It has some recognition. It's, you know, one of the best British films, and it's a great Hitchcock film and everything, but when people think of Hitchcock, they still think of, you know, your Rear Windows, your Psychos, your Rope, or Vertigo, or that sort of thing. And it's a shame, because this is, I can't think of anything really wrong with it you know, this is a fun family adventure, you know, that happens to have, you know, a bit of scariness with the thriller, and, you know, a really engaging romance as well. You know, we've touched on it briefly, but I really enjoy Iris and Gilbert's kind of relationship throughout, you know, because they start off completely hating each other and that sort of thing, and then they start rooting for each other and looking after each other, and it's just, it's a very nice payoff and all that sort of thing. And, you know, you have a lot of comedy in it, and it's just, it's one of the ones I would recommend to anyone if they are kind of thinking about checking out Hitchcock, or want to explore some of the older, you know, kind of pre-big Hollywood era sort of ones, because it is so enjoyable, and it's got instant repeat value. In fact, I have watched it all the way through and then gone, I've got another 90 minutes, and just wound it back, and I'm like, yeah, I still really enjoy it. Well, it's like, I just like the DVD menu, just kind of like, I'm like, I could press play, but I know it'll just cycle back, so I may as well just wait and just, oh, there we go, start it again, and just watch the whole way through again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Orson Welles saw it 11 times, so it's got a lot of fans. But...
Yeah, right on. My favorite, the last thing I want to talk about, one of my favorite things in the film is when Gilbert finally believes her. because, you know, we had the previous scene of the Froy being written on the window and it gets erased by the steam.
Yeah.
Which I, you know, sciencely, I'm not sure if that will quite work that way, but that's okay. But I loved how the cook just throws the stuff out the window and the tea bag lands on the window and then it disappears. So he's got no proof either. But, you know, what proved it for him is seeing something on the window. And she tried to show him something on the window and it disappeared. And now this thing on the window has also disappeared. I just love the parallel symbolism with that. And then he walks in and he finally believes her, you know, and he tells her subtly that he believes her and whatnot. So I really love that sequence as well. There's some really great things in this movie and I love it a lot. So I think we should probably rate it. What do you think, Tom?
I'll give it 4.5 boxes of tea I brought with me.
Chris, did you have a rating for the film?
I am going to give it 5 out of 5 nuns who aren't really nuns but get a redemption moment.
Farron, did you have a rating for the film?
Oh, I'll give it 5 out of 5 champagne bottles sent up to my room by the hotelier who secretly likes me.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think I, you know, Tom, I'm going to steal his. He got the tea. I got to go 5 out of 5 million Mexicans drinking it. So,
and make the water hot. Anyway.
Yes, absolutely boiled. You know, I got to say that I got to start boiling. We drink a lot of tea when our kids have colds, and we usually microwave the water because it's like we just got to get it done quickly, and they don't like it so hot. And we should probably drink like boiled water. I bet you it tastes a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho, I was thinking that. Farron, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. You're welcome back anytime. If there's any other Hitchcock films that are coming down the pipe that you want to talk about, just let us know. We would love to have you back. Please, once again, tell the listeners where they can find your work, where they can follow you on Twitter, things like that.
I'm still at the blog Self-Styled Siren. I'm Self-Styled Siren on Twitter. And, you know, I write here and there around the web, so keep looking.
Excellent. Right on. Chris, where can people find you when you're not gaslighting everybody you know?
I resent that. Is it true? I don't know. You'll never find out. No, you can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. Aside from Good Evening, I also do a couple of the podcasts. I do North by Nerdwest, which is it's me and my best mate Emma Platt. We just chat and have fun and, you know, discuss kind of pop culture and social issues. And yeah, we have a lot of fun. We took a bit of time out last year, and we are hoping to get some new episodes out in time for this year. We are on SoundCloud and iTunes and Blogger, so feel free to check out the first 12 episodes there. I also appear on a bunch of other podcasts fairly regularly, including Eccentric Earth, which is my sort of new favourite one, in that it's me and a mate of mine, Amy Walker, and I pop in fairly regularly, and she talks about a history topic, but I don't know what she's going to talk about until the episode starts, and I then have to go kind of like, oh, okay, oh, and I've learnt so much cool history. It's so good. But yeah, there's tons of other podcasts as well that I've appeared on, including Pick a Disc, and just a load. If you have a look at my Twitter feed, I'm always talking about some up, so yeah.
If it's a British podcast, you've been on it.
I mean,
I just now thought I forgot to mention my novel. I wrote a novel called Missing Wheels that is on Amazon.com and, you know, in indie booksellers nationwide still. So, you know, it is about the search for a missing silent film. There are, you know, a couple of Hitchcock references in it. So there is also my novel.
Excellent. Right on.
I'm ordering that.
Thank you. It's in the UK too.
Tom, where can people find you when you're not putting secret codes in jaunty little jingles?
Tom Caldwell 3000 on Twitter, the Tom Caldwell on Instagram, and there are a couple of tertiary podcasts that I've done here and there, but nothing worth mentioning at this juncture. So yeah, look for me. As we say, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, comment, like, share, tell your friends and family, make people sit down and listen to our show. We appreciate every single listener that we get.
I must say, this has been one of the most enjoyable podcast experiences I've had. You guys are really terrifically friendly and funny, and I had a good time.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much. We're so happy to hear that. That's great. We love it. So as for me, I got quite a few projects on the go. You can find me over on Trek FM talking Star Trek. I host a podcast called Warp 5 with my pen Patrick, which is all about Star Trek Enterprise. I host a music podcast called Melodic Treks, which is all about the music of Star Trek. Intermittently, I'm on Cinematic Sound Radio, and that podcast is called Breaking the Waves. It's all about electronic film scores. And now both episodes of Jason Cullimore's interview, who did our wonderful theme song, have been released. So be sure to check him out. Check out that interview because he's a real great guest to talk to. And then my friend Zach and I have a podcast called Franchise Fatigue, where we go over all the movies, all the sequels, all the remakes in a franchise, and we go through them one at a time. And as of this recording, I'm not quite sure what we'll be doing when the release is, but we're right in the middle of the Godfather films. We're getting ready to record our episode on Godfather 3 next week. And that's a lot of fun because I'm looking forward to convincing them that it is a masterpiece. It's not as good as the other two, but it is a masterpiece nonetheless.
Oh, I mean, good luck.
Thank you so much to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. You can find our episodes in their feed as well as our own independent feed. And be sure to check out Annie and Catherine, our good friends, who have a podcast called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. They are back, and they are doing episodes again. They cover all the episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is a good time. It's a good podcast. They have a lot of fun over there. And be sure to check out Jason Cullimore's work, jasoncullimore.com, and you can find us on Twitter at Good Evening Pod, and you send us an email, goodeveningpodcast@hotmail.com, and we're on Facebook. Well, next time, I'm looking forward to it because I've only seen it once, but I remember loving it. Jamaica Inn is coming up. I'm really looking forward to checking this film out again to see if it is as good as I remember it being or if it's not as good as I remember it being. So that's what I'm looking forward to talking about next. But until next time, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.